From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The center now presents part two in its series of discussions about cultural and aesthetic modernism in the arts, literature, and religion. The speakers in this portion of the conversation are Harvey Gross, Kejia Yuen, Diane Leonard, James Olney, and Stephen Marcus. Professors Olney, Marcus, Yuen, and Gross are scholars at the National Humanities Center, specializing in comparative literature, literary history, and criticism. Diane Leonard teaches comparative literature at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Here is Harvey Gross.
I'll pick up on a remark Stephen Marcus made about the redemptive element in modernism and in modern literature. I think chiefly of one of the great novels of the age, Malraux's Man's Fate, where that certainly is the thematic center. I'd like to ask Kejia Yuen if the element, the redemptive element, enters into the religion, into the literature of modern China, and especially in the context of a situation in which there is no official religious or institutional force, or religion as an institutional force is probably not as strong as it is in the West. Kejia, would you like to say?
Well, in my country, you know, communist ideas are assumed to be generally accepted by the people, and literary creation, as a matter of fact, is very much affected by this political belief. So, for a long time, I think we did produce some good works, which reflects the political sentiments and the beliefs of the Chinese people, describing those heroes, revolutionary heroes, who sacrificed their own interests for the sake of the people and for the cause of revolution. It seems like these are abundant, of course, in our literary works. But there, some also bad effects of this kind of political indoctrination. Well, some writers have produced films or novels in which characters are mere embodiment of political slogans. Characters who are not lively drawn, where they just voice the political lines of the party, and well, gradually it became a kind of a formula, you know. So now, after I think since 1978, well, there is a there has been a more emphasis upon artistry, upon the way to create characters in fiction or in drama, to make them more lively, more imaginatively drawn, and less, of course, we still put much emphasis upon the ideological correctness of the content, meaning namely that the effect of the work or the should be beneficial to the people. Should do no harm to the people engaged in revolutionary construction. Yeah.
Professor Yuen, has there been any kind of a noticeable religious dimension to any of that?
Well, because, you know, we have no official religion for many years now. We just, most people, I think, just take socialism as a kind of ideal society, ideal system of society, to as a goal for the for our own good. So I don't think it can be compared to religion, because religion is a kind of mysticism. Socialism, I think, is based on political economic science, and it's not a form of religion.
While we're on the topic of religious elements in modernism, I'd like to speak momentarily about the about this idea of mysticism and the search on the part of some modernist artists for alternative forms of religion, things that were not institutionalized, were not sanctioned by the society. There was a tradition that was prominent, particularly in the visual arts, that derived from mathematics in the 19th century, a tradition about other dimensions of reality than the three dimensions with which we're familiar. Specifically, there was a concept of the fourth dimension, which was very important for some of the Russian futurist painters, for some of the cubists who were working in Paris in the 20s. It entered into Proust's novel. He speaks of a church as existing in the fourth dimension. I think perhaps Virginia Woolf, through her acquaintance with painters, was somewhat familiar with this tradition. It was a belief that we exist in a universe which has other dimensions, but we can only see three of them. And we must therefore train ourselves in ways, again, of perceiving things which are not readily apparent. Interestingly, this was begun particularly in England in late 19th century by a mystic named Hinton, and a Russian named Uspensky picked up Hinton's ideas and translated some of his works, and also Gurdjieff, who right now is undergoing a lot of popularity because of the film about him. And these ideas were, through Madame Blavatsky, transferred to Yeats and a group of English writers. It's very interesting. We have a rather widespread phenomenon here in which a number of relatively minor pieces on a certain mystical view become very strongly influential for a number of major writers. And I think that says something about modernism in its attempt to look for alternative forms of achieving insights or a sense of wholeness that most artists could not connect with in organized religion.
I have a little trouble with regard to Yeats. Yeats says at one point in his autobiography is that, having been denied the possibility of simple belief by scientific movements of the 19th century, Huxley and Tyndall, he names, he turned to gathering together a sort of bundle of mystical and artistic figures, as a matter of fact. He sees the clear relationship between, I think this is in the early work in particular, clear relationship between the between art, poetry, and religion, and he says he made religion out of this tradition of poetry to which he was subscribing. And as for Madame Blavatsky, I don't think that Yeats actually got those ideas from Madame Blavatsky. He met her later on, but he was involved in the Order of the Golden Dawn before he had anything to do with Madame Blavatsky. And I think Yeats's claim, at least, would be that the belief to which he came was a result of contacts with peasantry in the west of Ireland, he maintains, going around with Lady Gregory and collecting stories, in which he says, in the beliefs of the peasants of the west of Ireland, he says he discovered the same ideas, the same mythological motifs, and the same beliefs as he could discover in the mystical traditions in Burma or whoever. And to pick up on what you were saying about the mathematics of mysticism, Yeats would trace it all the way back to Pythagoras, for whom numbers were magical, mysterious, mystical. In numbers resided the real mystery for Pythagoras, and Yeats was very conscious of that, I think, and that he saw that a kind of mathematical undergirding to a mystical belief as going, being present in the beliefs in the west of Ireland, in Swedenborg, he says, in Burma, and the whole tradition of mysticism in the west, and then all the way back to Pythagoras.
I think what this touches upon is a very complex polarity which is inclusive of our discussion, which has to do with the relation between the rational and the irrational. Yeah. And again, one can trace, as it were, an arc of development here. If we start again with the Romantic poets, they were very interested in things which were not considered rational by the Enlightenment, into various kinds of subjective experiences and personal experiences and so on. But they were not, as a rule, with the exception of Blake, perhaps, opposed to science and the spread of rationality. Wordsworth says, if the scientist makes this discovery, the poet will be there alongside of him, you know, translating scientific discovery, you know, into poetry. Shelley is very interested, for example, in science. You know, Keats, for all his, you know, making jokes about it, was trained as a physician and so on. So that at the beginning we have an interest in the irrational, but a simultaneous interest in science and the growth of the rational. This goes through permutations. By the time we come to the modernisms that we're discussing, I think, what we see is a changed situation altogether. Our modernist painters and poets and novelists and musicians are in some measure lamenting the loss of the older rationality, that is, the certitudes, let's say, of liberal empirical rationality, the certitudes about the possibility of rational progress, let's say, in society and in culture in the modern world, are no longer possible, and they make much more sustained forays and explorations of the irrational and into the irrational now than their predecessors. And indeed, the irrational comes to begin to inform parts of the structure of their work, as well as supplying the content of the work. When we come to the late modernists, and perhaps we might begin to introduce the postmodernist idea now, the rational seems to have disappeared over the horizon. starting, let's say, with a figure, an early modernist, but really, as it were, visionary pre-postmodernist figure, new category, like Kafka. Let's say that the idea of the rational is a kind of dream which keeps vanishing. By the time you get to Beckett, it's no longer a dream; it's just a vague memory. Let's say, you know, that this is a, and when you get to such distinctive postmodern figures, let's say, as Thomas Pynchon, you know, the form that rationality takes is insanity. That is to say, paranoia. The structures are the structures of paranoia and various other kinds of psychosis. So that what one sees here is a steady, as it were, bifurcation or splitting apart, so to speak, in many ways, of the relation between the rational and the irrational, with the two, which were once fairly close together, becoming further and further apart.
So, and I think that the figure that you mentioned earlier as being central or transitional in this whole process, Freud, mm-hmm. is very, very much the transitional figure here, because he was exploring the irrational, precisely the irrational, but he was trying to do it with scientific means, as he felt them to be. He was being purely scientific and dealing with it according to all the best scientific method as he understood it, but the material in which he was working was the irrational. And then as one moves on, Stephen has said, with Kafka, Beckett, and Thomas Pynchon, the irrational becomes, they're no longer interested in holding off the irrational by the scientific methodology. They just engage in the irrational purely.
And at this point, I think it might be pertinent to mention the concept of anti-art, because by the time you get to some of the postmodern figures, they're not only bringing irrational structures into their style and into their techniques of composition, but they are bringing into, say, music, noise, in Cage and the developments that come after Cage. No distinction is really made between a musical tone and a noise. Similarly, in the postmodern developments in art, a happening. The whole concept of what a work of art is shattered, becomes completely irrational. A work of art could be a urinal mounted in a frame. It could be somebody scattering plastic, yards of plastic over the countryside. A work of art can be anything the artist defines it as. So that, again, this represents probably the extremity of what Stephen was saying about the bifurcation of the rational and irrational, and in some cases, the irrational taking over completely.
Well, the interesting thing, however, is that even that irrationality, which is so problematical, as indeed I think most of us feel, you know, it is in terms of genuine achievement, has to be seen, it seems to me, against the background of the ever-increasing rationalization, if not rationality, of technological life in modern society. That is to say, as the modern world becomes more, as it were, rationalized in Max Weber's sense, who is another one of those figures who was trying to rationalize the irrational, very much the way Freud was, and who saw, in his grim, tragic vision, the inevitable conquest of the world of feeling and authentic response by bureaucracy, efficiency, rationality, and finally technologies of one kind or another. Even things as problematical as the kinds of irrational art that you're talking about come to make, as it were, a peculiar kind of sense in a context, you know, of ever-increasing, ever-dominating, ever-more penetrating technology and rationalization of life with which we're all familiar. This doesn't give those works of art. The interesting thing is that this doesn't give those works of art the redemptive power that the classic modernist works have. One understands them a little better this way, but they somehow, and for reasons which are not quite clear to me, don't have the kind of recreative, as it were, rejuvenating, vivifying power that one associates with the great modern, with the great modernist figures.
This brings up the question too, is the epic of modernism past, and are we waiting for something to happen? That we're in a kind of interregnum period where all of the great modernist figures are dead. I think Ezra Pound died in the late 70s. I think he was the last one. Who has taken their place? Certainly I don't think it's Thomas Pynchon.
In fact, wasn't what we're calling modernism, wasn't it? Was it ever stable enough to say, here are the... Stephen was referring a moment ago to the great modernist works, and I was tempted to ask him which ones are the great modernist works. And I think of a figure like Eliot, who is so much at the center of what one wants to say about modernism. And when one takes Eliot for a modernist figure, it's always the wasteland that one's talking about, almost always the wasteland one's talking about, possibly Prufrock. Harvey Gross has referred to that. But I think neither of those is Eliot's great work. His great work is unquestionably his great work, I think, and it's not a modernist poem. I don't see how it can be called a modernist poem.
Well, I would call it a modernist poem, but I think when we talk of the great modernist figures, we're speaking among others of Faulkner, of Joyce, of Proust, of Wolfe, of Kafka, of Thomas Mann. I think we would agree on that. And I think we are in the death throes of modernism, and maybe we're in kind of at the end of the whole epoch that began with Romanticism, although these are huge overgeneralizations. But it seems to me that what we have now, what has been characterized as the literature of exhaustion, is symptomatic of the fact that this era of our culture is worn out, and nothing has yet been born again. And another symptom of this that I see is the extreme emphasis on criticism of an almost technological variety. The critic has now taken over the role of the poet in our culture, as George Steiner has pointed out, among others. And this seems to me very symptomatic of the end of an era.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to part two in a series of conversations originating at the National Humanities Center about cultural and aesthetic modernism. The speakers in this portion of the discussion are Harvey Gross, Diane Leonard, Stephen Marcus, and James Olney. Professors Marcus, Gross, and Olney are scholars at the National Humanities Center, each specializing in literary history, criticism, and comparative literature. Professor Leonard teaches comparative literature at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Here is Harvey Gross.
Saying the great original scandal of modern art was that it was difficult. And the problem of difficulty immediately attached itself to the works, to such characteristic works as The Wasteland or Schoenberg's atonal compositions, which to many people are still incomprehensible. Now, I don't know what, I think Eliot has been no longer considered difficult. He's taught in high school. Proof Rock is a piece included in high school anthologies. On the other hand, Schoenberg has never been accepted by audiences. Say from 1910 to 1980, in the 70 years, people still walk out when they play Schoenberg at symphony concerts. So there's no question that the problem of difficulty in some cases still remains. Some modern artists, however, have been acclimated, and no one thinks of Thomas Mann as a difficult writer, or Proust as a difficult writer. Painting is something else, because the various schools of abstraction have, in a sense, continued the scandal. I think the painters have enjoyed continuing the early scandal. Diane, what you seem to be ready to burst into song here.
I'm just very surprised that no one considers Proust a difficult writer. I think he remains very difficult, and it seems to me that some of this difficulty also is related to this the strand that Stephen Marcus was pointing out, the opposition between what he was calling the rational and the irrational. I think I might have categorized those poles a little differently, but nevertheless, it seems to me there is an impulse here in the very complexity of the art to make it something that should be inaccessible to mere reason, that one should have to, again, approach this in some way that in some cases is almost a mystical, non-rational mode of understanding.
How do the audiences think of these artists?
Originally, the first audiences for most modernist works were outraged. By them, outraged by the difficulty of them, and outraged by the conscious impulse which carried over from the late 19th century to épater la bourgeoisie, which was part of the conscious stance of these artists. They were going to outrage the respectable middle-class audience whom they hoped would buy their stuff at the same time. I mean, that's part of the marvelous contradiction that they were involved in, because they all wanted to make some money, too. They didn't want to be unread or unheard or unseen, too. Now, it seems to me one of the paradoxes of the contemporary world, that not only is Proof Rock read in high school, so is Kafka. The kids and seniors in high school read The Metamorphosis, let's say, or something like that. Heaven knows what they understand by that work, but they read it nevertheless. At the same time, the painters have achieved the kind of hat trick which almost nobody else did. That is to say, they became involved, the modern painters became involved with capitalism, or with money.
With the dealers, yes.
With big money.
Yeah.
And so the most advanced and apparently outrageous painters or painting have tax problems. That is to say, there are people like Pollock and de Kooning and Rothko and so on, as one knows, became millionaires with the most advanced abstract kind of thing. This was not true of music. Music is the one area, it seems to me, in which it was not true. And the audience for music, for the kind of music of that Harvey is referring to, of Schoenberg and post-Schoenberg, is almost entirely made up of other musicians, rather than a general public. So one can't, as it were, simply generalize across the board here. One has to make differences. It seems to me, however, though, that with the exception of music, most modernist works have been assimilated to the very culture that they were supposed to be exploding. That is, they've become part of the culture that they were, as it were, shooting at and taking aim at the same time. Now, this, one can say, this fate overcomes every movement in the history of art. But I don't think that historically, before this, there had ever been such a concerted set of efforts, as it were, to take aim critically let's say, at the social cultural world as one had, let's say, in the modernisms, and such an assimilation, as it were, of those works to the world that they were supposed to, as it were, subvert, overturn, be opposed to, and so on. That clearly is one of the paradoxes that we're still living with, and that nobody, I think, is very much at ease with.
Could I suggest that I don't know how one's to account for what Stephen has just called the hat trick of modern painters, but for the other art forms, that there, as we've said earlier, progressively the artist from the writer from the time of Rousseau on turned more and more inward until eventually the only possible subject became the artist's self in quite a direct way. The artist writing about himself, and the audience became other people writing about themselves. Beyond that, in poetry, for example, poetry frequently was about the subject matter of poetry was poetry, writing poetry, which one even finds in four quartets, so maybe it's modernist to that degree. But the subject matter of poetry became poetry, and that's a very in-turn thing, and the audience became other artists who were doing the same thing. Or, as some artists have said, they write for themselves, and only for themselves. They write to satisfy themselves. Then the paradox that this has been picked up and has been, everyone now reads Kafka. Kafka is read in high school. I wonder if one can account for that by saying that if high school students are reading The Metamorphosis, for example, they're reading it and finding something in there because they feel the kind of alienation now that Kafka was representing when he wrote Metamorphosis, and the society has come to see itself reflected somehow in that story that Kafka wrote well in advance of their feeling of alienation, but now they experience, it's as if he reflected society before society had really come to that, before society at least knew it had come to that.
That's a prophetic role, of course, that many of the modern artists seem to have assumed, that they were aware of, sensitive to, the antennae of the race, mm-hmm. is what Pound called them, to the cultural shocks that were going to take place.
As to music, again, I was listening to the radio the other evening, and they played a composition of Elliot Carter's, and they prefaced it by having Elliot Carter talk about the what he was doing in there. And that's the only way I think that anybody, except a professional musician, a composer, would ever know what was going on or have any kind of tie with what Elliot Carter was doing. Very, very difficult piece of music. And he talked for quite a long time in quite technical terms about what he intended to do in here and the means by which he intended to accomplish that. That's a phenomenon of modernism, I think, for the artist to be explaining what he's doing.
It also brings up what Diane Lennon mentioned, the prevalence and the import and the influence of criticism itself, and that in the development of modernism, there also develops these very sophisticated schools of criticism, beginning with the new criticism which comes out of Eliot, who himself was a poet and a critic and practiced both.
You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The center is interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for part two in the Center's series on cultural and aesthetic modernism. How do questions of belief, religious or artistic, and the interplays of the rational and the irrational, the secular and the sacred, connect with modern politics, literature, and the arts? Be listening for answers and insights this week from the National Humanities Center and Soundings.